So this is KHEN 106.9 Salida, and tonight with my co-host Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and again we'll introduce Alan Watt. Go ahead.
Well, okay, we have with us Alan Watt, who has a website called Cutting Through the Matrix. And he lives in Canada, but grew up in Scotland. And he has really got a holistic grasp, I think, of what's going on in the world right now. He's been, I think, doing a lot of radio talk show interviews lately. Is that correct, Alan?
Yeah, and I've been on RBN, my own show as well.
Yeah, and we're lucky enough to have him with us from Ontario. I think it's probably 2 hours later, so we really appreciate you joining us, Alan.
No, and it's a pleasure.
And we're looking forward to what you can tell us. These are interesting times, and you have basically the notion that that we are living in a matrix, much perhaps like the movie. And could you explain perhaps what you mean by what is this matrix, and could you give us an idea of what the nature of the matrix is that we're living in?
Yeah, the matrix is a worldview that's presented to you at birth that didn't simply evolve by itself. It's a structured world where you're indoctrinated from birth in a really what seems to be an evolving evolutionary manner, but in reality it was designed that way, and that's not far-fetched at all when you go back to the writings of Aldous Huxley and other main authors of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, etc., who were players in the big think tanks that worked for the wealthy elites of Europe, especially Britain. And they were members of the aristocratic families themselves. Huxley's grandfather was Sir Thomas Huxley, that was the best friend of Charles Darwin. And he took over the Darwinistic theory that was very important to all of this whole movement on behalf of the elite, with eugenics, with class divisions, and how they rationalized what they'd have to do in the future and expand the system of theirs across the globe. On the one hand, they'd tell the public it was for world peace, but in reality, they decided long ago that there would be only one culture, one system worldwide, and they wanted to reshape everything that was left imperfect, as they say, which was basically man himself, the common people. They knew the industrial era would come to an end. They had already plans. I have the books from the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs from the 1930s, where, from the minutes of their meetings, where they discussed the coming world they were going to create. They even discussed a coming World War II, before it happened, before there was any war declared. And they even discussed the fact they'd have to save the Soviet system by all means. Now, this is the top institution that's chartered by the British royalty to set up. It was set up to create global government based on a British system of free trade and enterprise, but also to incorporate the same governmental structures, a socialist-type system where you'd have almost a fascist elite at the top, which Britain has. It has a monarchy. It's a strange monarchy-democracy when everyone who takes a paycheck from the government swears allegiance to the Queen and not the country or the people. And that's the same for the whole British Commonwealth. But that structured system was to go across the whole planet. And in the early 1900s, they knew that they had to pass on the torch, as they say, to the U.S., because that's where the manpower would be for the future. That was the up-and-coming country for industry, and that's where the big taxation base would be to force this on the world. So the U.S. was to take over from Britain as the world police. And after the U.S. had expended itself with the takeovers of the Middle East and standardizing them under the same system, China was to take over from the U.S. And that was all discussed in the 1930s and published in their own books.
So I'm with you 100%. I've been reading along these same lines, and I imagine you've read and heard about Cecil Rhodes' will and the round table groups of England that functioned around 1900 with just the mandate that you mentioned, so that America would become the kind of the extension of the British Empire. So you would have the Anglo-American alliance, which would which would essentially take over.
And what you find, see, in Britain, they put out Cecil Rhodes initially to start up a private, non-governmental organization, but on behalf of the British elite and the monarchy, they would take over the world's resources. But then they merged eventually with the Lord Alfred Milner Group of Round Table Society that was also chartered by the monarchy. They merged together and became the Royal Institute for International Affairs. Again, a private, it sounds very governmental, but it's a private, non-governmental organization. And they would incorporate into their membership all politicians at a high caliber, and also most reporters of a high caliber, and that eventually incorporated down through the years to TV and radio. You'll find there are members of the CFR for America. They couldn't call it the Royal Institute for International Affairs in the U.S., so they called it the Council on Foreign Relations. But it's the same organization from the Pratt Building in New York that they set up. So that was for world government. Rudyard Kipling was sent over at the end of World War I, and he read his famous poem, We Pass the Torch On to You, The White Man's Burden. And that was read in front of the U.S. Senate at the time.
Yeah, so really the Matrix then is, I guess, another term for the New World Order. Would that be correct?
Yes, there's no doubt about it. We've been brought up, again, in this false matrix where we're taught that somehow we're all free. However, if you look into even the definition of a citizen, it'll tell you it's someone born into a system and that person has pre-existing duties to that system. And then you find you're numbered with your SIN number, social insurance number, and you're taxed your whole life long, and all you have to do is obey the rules, and you're given some time to play and be happy as long as you obey the rules, not to ask questions, and to accept under a socialist-type system that the people who come out of special wombs, these elite families at the top, these dynasties that we see entering politics all the time, these people are much more qualified to take care of the bigger problems than you are.
So they say.
Yeah. That's what they've trained most folk to believe. Yeah.
How did you get into the extent that you've got into the knowledge of this New World Order and Matrix?
Yeah, well, as I say, I grew up watching the height of the British Empire. When they opened up condemned buildings that were condemned 100 years before I was born, because for the first two world wars, they kept promising to give housing to the public, and the public, of course, would pay through their taxes, and they didn't cough up enough, so they opened up all these condemned buildings. And so I grew up watching and talking to and listening to adults talking and squabbling over money for rent and basic necessities. And I thought, well, how come if Britain is so old and they have this amazing empire over centuries, how come only a few hundred families in London seem to own anything? That was the first clue.
So you grew up?
And I realized I was in a system, and that the people were kept in that system through fear, primarily fear of poverty as the main one. That's why they'll always have poverty around you, to make sure you're terrified of it. You don't want to end up on the street. That's why they have homeless in the biggest cities in the Western world. They make sure they're there. They want you to see them. They don't want you to realize that you could be in a paradise if it's a different system. So they give you the homeless to make sure you're terrified of poverty. They make sure you're terrified of getting sick, loneliness, and all the usual things. And that's how the structured system keeps going. It's based on abuse.
Okay, and the...
Could you pipe the sound up a bit? I can't hear you.
Yeah, the way that this matrix is perpetuated over time, how is this done? Could you give us the
well,
nature?
Well, at the end, around the 1700s, they had all their wars as the big psychopathic families fought the other ones in other countries, or they had the people fight each other, I should say. And they benefited from them. But they knew that the speed of science, even in their day, that the weapons eventually were going to kill masses of people, and they knew the destruction would be terrible. And so they had international meetings. You can go back to the Concert of Europe when the elite met after Napoleon, and they decided on ways to keep the population down, because wars had always been used for that reason, even as far back as the days of ancient Greece. So they had to find ways of keeping the people in check. And so they hired the best Machiavellian type of advisors they could, and created the early think tanks. We are run by think tanks. And they planned the future. They knew they'd have to give the public something called democracy, which really was an idea that your vote counted, someone would speak for you. But as everyone really knows today, the politicians, once they're in office, they vote for the party. Whatever the party leader says is where they go. So it's a complete farce, but we still have that impression that we have a say. It keeps us from having a revolution every 4 or 5 years. And they discussed that fact as well. So they gave us this fake democracy. And then, as Professor Carl Quigley said in Tragedy and Hope, he said the reason for war, he said, is primarily to change the cultures of all opposing nations. You can get more done in 5 years of war than 50 years of peace. So they've used war and democracy. We've had the bloodiest wars ever since they gave us democracy, standing armies and taxation that pays off the debt that's borrowed from the money that's borrowed for the wars. This was all planned 200 odd years ago, and they knew they would take us eventually to a global system.
Alan, I teach physical and environmental geography in my life as a professor, and one of the courses I've been teaching is human ecology, and of course we talk about environmental issues. And after 9/11, I've pushed us further and further into geopolitics, and even including things like economics and terrorism, etc. But one of the things that becomes obvious when you start to look at the big picture is that we have about 3,000 to 5,000 different indigenous cultures in this world, as well as about 30 million species other than humans. Yeah. The 3,000 to 5,000 indigenous cultures, each with a history, each with their own language, to break this system down, over which has evolved over thousands and thousands of years, into one monolithic culture, which I suppose is what the New World Order is aspiring to. This is an incredible challenge, and I guess this is how they intend to do it, through wars.
It's through war, and if you go back into the early writings of even John Stuart Mill, the top economist in Britain or London in the 1700s, and then his son took over with the same name, they had to categorize the indigenous peoples of the world, and through their top meetings and think tanks, they'd already come to the understanding that this one economic system must survive at any cost, and therefore everyone would have to fit into that system. Any people who could not fit into that system, and they had already marked out the American Indian in the 1700s, they said he wouldn't adapt to this economic system, they'd have to perish. And they also had the African, the ones who could mimic, their own words were mimic the white man, could survive, but those who could not would perish. And they even had the Irish marked down, and that was reiterated with H.G. Wells, who was a propagandist for the British government, in his book Outline of History. They had these lists drawn up long before Adolf Hitler.
This is in the 1700s you're mentioning?
Yeah.
Okay. And this, of course, is in the midst of about a 900-year war between England and Ireland, I guess. So the Irish have really struggled to maintain their culture over centuries,
yes,
haven't they? Yeah. And Scotland, I'm sure, has a similar situation. So by virtue of growing up in Scotland, you have a unique worldview, a view of the British Empire, I suppose.
Oh, there's no doubt. Very few people today even know how Britain colonized the Americas or Australia. But for the Americas, they couldn't get people to leave their homes. People don't like leaving their homes, especially when you have a very rich culture. And we had the Highland Clearances. They literally cleared out millions of people, put them on old wrecked ships, and the half of them that came across the Atlantic were put up to colonize the Americas. That's how they were put out at a gunpoint onto those ships.
And the British East
Australia,
yeah,
they created thousands of laws in a time of poverty, and you could get sent to Australia for stealing a loaf of bread.
And, of course, it was the British East India Company that was a private corporation that was sanctioned by the monarchy in England, which really founded Jamestown, Virginia.
That's right.
Colonized our country.
That's right. And even before that, King James had sent out. You probably heard about all the different bubbles they created with the investment boons that they tried and conned all the public out of their pension. But the first one was a colonization sent from Britain to the mouth of the Amazon River. And they called it Darius, the settlement Darius, after the old Persian king. And that got wiped out too. But thousands of people lost all that they had on these particular ventures going way back then.
So what we're really looking at is the kind of extension of an economic cultural system that has London as its center. Would you say that's the case?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. When you look at the history of the economic system, and money itself in the coinage form didn't exist before about 800 BC. And when you look at the histories of how countries were at war very shortly after money was introduced, and how the trapezi, as the Greeks called them, the money lenders, ended up buying and selling whole countries because of debt, and having wars. Once they'd taken you over, they'd standardize you into the same system, recruit the young men and send them off to more wars. So it was a takeover. The world is like a big takeover business, taking over one country, one empire after another. And it hasn't stopped yet. The goal has always been globalism. And it's not the same globalism or same culture as we think of it today. The system they're going to bring into play is right from Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. They're going to reshape and recreate humans to serve them better. Humans that won't need entertainment. Humans who won't even need pay of any kind. That'd be the ideal design. That's the other meaning of ID.
Could you repeat that last phrase about the ID?
Well, that's the other little hidden little chuckle we have when we say ID. ID is also ideal design. Well, we're imperfect according to the top boys, and they want to reshape us into being better servants.
Okay, you're talking about an intergenerational plan with a specific goal, which has been loosely referred to as the New World Order. Could you elaborate on what kind of goal or New World Order they envision?
Yes, it's a utopia for an elite, where guys like Charles Galton Darwin, the grandson of Charles Darwin, who wrote the book The Next Million Years, where he outlined their whole agenda on behalf of the elite. And why they'd have to, and this is in 1954 or 55 he published the book, and he outlined why they'd have to sterilize the people. Well, you probably know the UN reports every year on the sperm count of the Western males, down 75% by the UN's own admission. And it's not a crisis. It just happened according to the book. And how they'd have to create diseases, introduce diseases into the population, to cripple them, make them unwelcome as marriage partners. Nobody wants you if you're sick all the time, and that would bring the population down. But they also wanted to go a step further, and that was to introduce genetic interference and genetic manipulation, which is really the whole basis of the thing. These are the guys at the top who are the top eugenicists as part of the religion. Really, they believe in the class difference. They believe they are the most evolved species on the planet by their own standards, because they've acquired a credible wealth, they've managed to hold on to power through generations, and that's the ticket to belong to their club.
Would you say
those who haven't made it, we're the junk genes, as they laughingly call us. We're the junk genes, and therefore we can be disposed of.
Then why would they, on one hand, try to encourage propagation, and on the other hand, they, you know, it's kind of like sowing seeds. Instead of, you know, planting what you need, they just throw lots out there and then cull out what, you know, they don't want. Is that what you're saying?
It's, if you can take it back to the Human Genome Project, it was all over and done with before the public even knew there was they were doing this project. They were mapping the gene codes of every individual who'd ever had blood drawn. And we don't ask any questions as to why. Why is this so important to them? And why was there so much secrecy? And never mind the incredible amount of money it costs to do it all. But why were they mapping the gene codes of everyone on the planet? Why was this a priority, all done in secret? And we do know from writings that have come out since, there's even a professor in England come out in the Daily Mail this last few days, stating they're creating a new type of caste system where there'll be genetically enhanced ones at the top and an inferior class of malformed people down below. This is now coming out in the mainstream media, and it's pushed by the same descendants of the same characters that gave us Brave New World.
In other words, they're using what they're using on the masses to scare them from, you know, with the poor and that sort of thing. They're also subject to their own propaganda then. I mean, does that make sense to you, what I'm saying here? In other words,
could you pipe up the sound a bit there?
Okay. They're somewhat subject to their own propaganda if they do to themselves what they're doing to the rest of us, in a sense.
Well, they don't really, because I looked into the laws to do with genetically modified food, for instance. And even though Tony Blair, when he was in, made it a law that all the British would have to eat it and would not be told what was modified and what was not, he made an exception, and that was for all the politicians and their own cafeterias and special outlets that would serve the wealthy. We know that the British aristocracy still have masses of farms, you know. They grow all their own food. They don't, their cattle are not inoculated and pumped full of antibiotics and so on. And they have their own granaries, etc. They don't eat what we eat.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they really then do envision maybe a splitting off of a master race from the rest of us, and they are that master race, and they are going to accomplish
this. They truly are. Yeah, they truly believe they are.
Yeah.
And they have made their plans so carefully. I mean, everything is interlocking today. When Rumsfeld said this war could take 100 years, and anyone who thought at all was saying, well, wait a minute, how long would it take them to take over the Middle East? He wasn't talking about the Middle East. He was talking about changing the cultures and the system for the entire planet. That's what he meant.
If I could just make a kind of a little bit of a diversion here, it might not be a diversion. What is the role, do you think, Alan, of religion in all of this?
Well, religions have always had good shepherds, and they always, that means that everyone else who follows is a sheep. And religion has always been used to control people, so there's no doubt about it. And a neat thing within human personality is a feeling, a sense that there's something bigger out there than just us, something we can't see, but we know it's there, we think it's there. And that's been utilized and used against the public by very clever people for thousands of years. And, you know, the purpose of the shepherd is always to convince the sheep that their directions lay in the same direction, their best interests are in the same direction. That's the trick of the shepherd. But of course the function of the sheep, which is one of the most stupidest animals, is to be eaten and to provide wool for its master.
So the analogy of the shepherd and sheep, you would say they've managed to take that basic kind of biological reality and make it attractive by packaging it in a religion that makes people want to sign on. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and also, too, because, I mean, most people can go into the research, even the mainstream research, it's all, what amazes me is the people at the top do publish so much about themselves and their agenda. You don't. H.G. Wells even called it the open conspiracy because they published what they wanted to do when they wrote all the books for the League of Nations, which became the United Nations. It was all published out in the open. It's just that it was not an exciting read. There's no sex in there or detective stories or murders as we know them. But they've published their writings, and what gets me is that they have trained the public, like big players like Huxley, who worked at the Tavistock Institute for propaganda, really, for predictive programming, and he was one of them, along with Sir Bertrand Russell, or Lord Bertrand Russell, who said shortly the public can be made to believe anything with adequate governmental backing and repetition. Well, they've done it. Most folk believe whatever they're told by the mainstream media, and it doesn't occur to them they're being lied to.
So what is the UN's part in this, then? I mean, is it...
Well, the UN, again, H.G. Wells, who was a propagandist, and he was the one who coined the term the war to end all wars. That's how they got the whole world fighting. Everybody thought there'd be peace at the end of it. And so they used slogans to their maximum effect. But H.G. Wells himself wanted to belong to this elite club. And he was the son of a fallen middle-class man who was a bit of a drunk, and whose only employment was to play for cricket teams as a spare part man type of thing. But he was brought up in a wealthy home because his mother was a housemaid or the housekeeper of an aristocratic family. And Wells loved the lifestyle, and he began to fear even the working people walking past the window. He didn't want to join their ranks, so he developed a hatred for the working classes. And he himself published a book when the League of Nations was set up, and he said that this organization will lead to world government. And he said effectively all nations now have been neutered because bureaucratic teams can negotiate with other bureaucratic teams at the League of Nations without going through the politicians, and that's how the world would be controlled. And it's true enough, no one elects bureaucrats, and there's far more bureaucrats who know their own part in this agenda. They're given mandates which are intergenerational, and they last longer than we do. So they can follow through a mandate, and they do it quietly, and there's no heat from the public.
I've read in one of your articles here, Alan, that you're talking maybe about some 3,000 people that might be actually running the world. And if that's
yes,
the case...
Yes, really, the amount of families that run this world, when you look through the rich and famous, they only boil down to about 3,000. They do have other cousins, etc., and second, third, and fourth, etc., down through history and through society, but mainly, yeah, there's always about 3,000 of them in the limelight. And we see some of them once in a while at meetings like the Bilderbergers or other exotic meeting places. They've even had ones in the past in the Middle East where they signed UN accords. And whenever they sign an accord towards something at the United Nations, we should look into it very, very carefully, because each part of each accord is going to take effect and affect everyone's life. The water, even the idea of to take over the water of the whole world, the water supply of the planet, was decided back in the 1960s at a world meeting at the United Nations.
Well, this is very interesting, and you have on your website a copy of Agenda 21, I believe,
yeah.
And you understand the importance of that. Could you relate that perhaps to this world takeover of resources?
Yes, Agenda 21 is the United Nations agenda for the 21st century, which they published themselves. And what they have down in their books is a plan which will happen. It's actually happening now. Apart from taking over all of the resources of the world into these big, very certain selected international corporations, that's where it's all to go. Carl Quigley called it a new type of feudalism, where the feudal overlords will be the CEOs of corporations. Well, that's already happened with the intertwining of politics and international corporations as a form of fascism. But Agenda 21, they even have their own maps where areas within the United States, Canada, and the rest of the world will be habitat areas for humans. And if you look at them, there's going to be a big reduction in the population for us all to fit into those particular areas. But they've also set up, just like the Soviet Union had, that they've set up big, new, brand new buildings and so on, habitat areas for a bureaucratic managerial elite, where they won't live in the cramped conditions of the rest of us who'll be bunged into the big cities.
So they actually have kind of an idea to put most of the masses, the unwashed masses, into maybe an equivalent of reservations or slums, and then
yes,
keep pristine land for themselves. Is that correct?
That's correct, and it's quite interesting because you'd understand these internationalists were talking about world government as far back as Queen Elizabeth I's court in the 1500s. And John Dee wrote about it. He coined the term the British Empire. And he said this would be an empire based on the same system as Britain, which was a monarchy, remember. And he said we shall introduce free trade for those corporations that are worthy to join on condition that their countries adapt the same system as Britain. And he says we shall get a most favored nation trading status. That was in the 1500s. They're signing those very deals with the same terminology today.
But some of that terminology kind of means the opposite of what it
always trade, does, yes.
Yeah,
it's not free trade for the average person or small business. It's for selective, I call them pirates myself, selective corporations only.
So Agenda 21, as I understand it, is a plan in the United States, which this country signed on to under Clinton in the 90s, to take large amounts of land and turn it into public land. And
yes.
Then this would then make it off limits to certain private uses. And then with the presumed idea, according to some, that this public land then might be turned over to these elites. Is that how you understand it?
That's right. They want to reduce the population. They want the existing populations to start moving into habitat areas. I can see them using the threat of plagues or terrorism to move whole peoples into the major cities. I talked to an architect back in the 70s who showed me, or so the 80s, sorry, and he showed me a design for a Toronto. And it was a big glass-type dome over Toronto, but a much smaller Toronto. And I asked him why it was so small. He says, well, it won't be the same population. I said, well, why the dome? And he wouldn't answer me. And this guy, who was the architect, architecture is his hobby, but he's a professional architect. Prince Charles is on his polo team. So this is he's a British lord now.
Wow.
And since then, the United Nations has sent me books that they put out asking my opinion on these very things. So they show you habitat areas with these big domes on them. There'll be one for the nurseries, one for the working people, and one for the elderly where they get care. And these are huge glass domes.
So does that mean that they've made the air a resource that is...
Saleable.
Yeah, I mean, what they could tell any population, and this is true, they know they can do this because they've done it already in other ways. They could convince the world, or even one generation that grew up in there, that the world outside was highly toxic and would kill you.
Mm.
And people would grow up just like the Logan's Run, the same idea, and obey and do what they're told and never think of going outside.
Alan, with your broad understanding of these things, which I really appreciate and really learning a lot here, maybe you can shed light on a situation we have locally here, which I've been involved with. We have in the San Luis Valley, southern central Colorado, a huge aquifer. Some say it's the largest aquifer in North America.
Is that the Boca Grande?
Yes, the Boca Grande. I live in the Boca Grande. And as you know, Maurice Strong bought the Boca Grande Ranch back in the 80s and had a plan to export water from that aquifer and make billions of dollars by selling it to Denver. He was apparently kind of chased out by local environmental groups. He sold it to a guy named Gary Boyce, who was local, who promised to be a good environmentalist. And then within a couple of years, he came up with the same plan. He was also chased out, at which point, a little bit later, that ranch then was sold to the Nature Conservancy, which held it for 3 years, and then it morphed into about between 2000 and 2003 or 4, morphed into the larger Great Sand Dunes National Park and the new Baca National Wildlife Refuge. Now, this is just brand new, and yet they haven't even got a plan for how to manage the Baca National Wildlife Refuge. And yet Lexham Explorations Company, which is out of Toronto, which owns the mineral rights, the gas rights, now has applied for gas permits to drill 14,000 foot down to exploit natural gas. Now,
yes.
this is the CEO is Rob McHugh, and another one of your fellow Canadians. So we're talking at the players being two Canadian billionaires, Marie Strong and Rob McEwen. Now, I don't know exactly what we're fighting. Are we fighting an attempt to take the natural gas? Are we fighting an attempt to get dominion over the water? Or
both.
Is it both?
It's both. This came out in Britain about 10 years ago. A bunch of politicians voted that they should privatize the waters in Britain. And all the waterworks systems that the public had built up through their tax money. And then those same politicians left office, and suddenly they became a corporation who ended up owning it. So they voted the bill through, privatized it, and then they bought it for peanuts. And we found there were big players behind them. But this Lexman Corporation is also based in Britain. And the whole thing was they would take over water and natural gas both together simultaneously. And they came to Canada to do the same thing, and they're also in the States. They're the ones who are authorized to do it worldwide, water and gas always together.
Now, when you say they are the ones, are you talking Lexham specifically or other groups, or are you just talking about British-based corporations?
Yeah. You find they're only one part of a corporation, a group, that are authorized to do this. They love to camouflage themselves in different countries to throw us off the scent, but they're all taking their orders from London. But I know that the aquifer you have down there, there was an article here years ago, because Maurice Strong, that was the front man for the Rockefeller Foundation, who funds all these wildlife programs and so on, set his ranch up there, and he was sitting on top of that aquifer for donkey's years. And Maurice Strong is a big player at the United Nations. He ran the World Bank for years. He then was sent over from the World Bank to all places to a job as Ontario Hydro chief and in charge of the electrical supply for the whole Ontario. He privatized the electrical supply, and once he'd done that, he was off again back to the United Nations. So Maurice Strong is a big player, and so whoever takes over from him is part of the same organization.
So the land in question right now is federal land, and it's U.S. government fish and wildlife. That doesn't seem to matter, does it?
No. No, and you see, we truly are living in a fascist system. As Quigley said, Professor Carl Quigley says, a new feudal system, with the CEOs of corporations being the new feudal overlords, and they get special rights and mining rights and so on, and all of this land, even the biospheres that they create for the United Nations. You'll always find that certain corporations are given the rights of mineral and water and so on.
So the wilderness areas and that sort are just kind of a transition till these corporations can come in and utilize the resources?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was discussed back at the Cecil Rhodes Foundation in the early days when they were sent off to take over the mineral rights of Africa, and how they would create supposed big parks everywhere, but in reality they themselves would have the rights without any competition to do all the exploration for the minerals, the gold and the diamonds.
So it's on the land, land conservancies and land trusts are part of this type of...
Yes.
Okay.
Could you explain
the interweaving of this is so amazing. It took such a long time to set it all up. And it's only now that some of the public are catching on when it all clicks together that none of this, you realize that none of this happened by chance. It took a lot of planning, and this is all over the world right now. And you'll find the same corporations, the same people floating about across the world, these big, heavy players, doing the same thing in your country as they are in Africa, for instance.
Is it likely that there are agents, say, of the military, the CIA, and the corporations themselves who are working at all levels to make sure this plan goes through?
There's no doubt. In fact, at the end of World War II, in fact, during World War II, they had meetings in London, and at that time they had the OSS, and they used to call the top man the Wizard of Oz, and that became the CIA for the U.S. They sent Stevenson over to create it, and they created the MI6 in Britain, and they both had the same mandate, really, and that was to infiltrate all areas of education, media, all information, and basically run and guide the show. And then they set up the main wire lines, AP routers, etc. And that would all get the same information or disinformation to standardize our thoughts and opinions. And it's true enough, everyone parrots what they hear on the news. It never dawns on us we're being lied to or treated like sheep or guided along a certain path of thought. We take everything for granted, and we're living, that's what I mean by the matrix, we're in the matrix.
So in terms of kind of some skillful way to oppose the resource takeover by these government and private entities, what do you have any advice whatsoever? I mean, we're dealing with a lot of money, we're dealing with a lot of power, we're dealing with military power, we're dealing with control of the press, we're dealing with people that have a lot on their side. So, and we as volunteer type citizens, we might form a, you know, San Luis Valley Citizens Alliance or a Water Watch Alliance or whatever, and we might hold little meetings. Is it futile to oppose this agenda, or do we just have to do the best we can?
I think we have to go about it in a different way, because what you find is that the politicians are always in the pockets of the top boys. Professor Carl Quigley, in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment, which everyone should read, it fills in all the blank pages in history and all the stuff we're talking about here. It tells you who started the wars, what they hoped to gain, and the kind of societies they hoped to bring through afterwards. And in Anglo-American Establishment, he talks about, he said it's not necessary that we, the Council on Foreign Relations, have every politician as a member. It's only necessary that in every house that comes in, we have the top man, that's the president, and his main advisors around him to be members. The rest of them are allowed a minor form of competition below them. But the ones at the top are always in the Council of Foreign Relations. And he said for 50 years, he published the book in the 1960s, he said for 50 years this parallel government has been in operation.
So a lot of these people that are in these organizations below the head people may not have a clue of what the head person is really up to. Is that what you're saying?
They don't have a clue, and most politicians, and I have no faith in politicians, I put them in the... Psychiatry used to label them under the attention-seeking hysterical psychopath. And I think that's very true. Politicians want to play the game to get brownie points with their seniors. They want to climb the ladder, and as soon as they've left you, you've voted them in. They don't represent you. They vote with the party leader. And so the whole point of voting locally is kind of deemed pointless if the guy doesn't speak for you. They don't make decisions. They vote with the party. And so we don't really have representation, and we don't have complaints departments in the system because it is a parallel government, and they haven't given us any complaints department.
Alan, before we leave this subject of the water monopolies and the privatization and the Agenda 21, I asked you, you know, what we could do, and you said you thought we have to do something different. And I was kind of hanging on your words there, and then we shifted to what would you recommend?
Well, I think for one thing, anyone getting taxpayers' money as a paycheck should have every organization that they've ever given an oath to on the books so the public can see it. Every affiliation that they belong to, every group. And you'll find with most of them, they're internationalists. They're all international. Even the Police Chiefs Association is worldwide. And almost every police chief in the planet is a member of this organization now. They take their orders and their mandates to do with right checks and all the stuff that we see. It all comes from the United Nations.
So your suggestion then is to get very detailed biographies of the individuals who are the main powerful players and then publish those and then ask them for some kind of accountability. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I mean, people who've already pledged themselves through organizations which are international in structure, how can you possibly vote them in to protect your national interests? It's a dialectic right there. It doesn't work, and that's what's happened for so long. When FDR gave you the New Deal, and people didn't realize what he meant by that, that was the Constitution out the window. He says, here's the New Deal, and they gave you the new system that was to be set up under the United Nations. And that's what they've done since. We've been given a phony type of government, while the real government's been racing ahead with its agenda.
Yeah.
So with you being, I see you're working hard to get the word out, and is that just to kind of get people to wake up, and then, you know, do you have any other suggestions beyond that? I mean.
Yeah, I think we have to stop following the media and entertainment. I hate to say it, but Bertrand Russell, Aldous Huxley, other ones since have said that. In fact, now I have declassified documents from the British government and the American government admitting that the CIA and MI6 created and the whole culture industry and ran it since the 1940s onwards. That was all the dances that you ever did, all the kinds of music they made popular, the kind of art you saw, the trends and promiscuity, all that stuff was fostered from the top, and it was guided. It wasn't by chance.
So you would say
and,
that...
That's now declassified. They even tell you the names of the characters involved who were given the money and the missions. And this is real stuff. It's not conspiracy. It's now declassified after 50 years of the startup.
So is the MI6 and the CIA that gave us the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and our other popular icons in the culture?
That's right.
Well,
and even the type of music.
Well, now, I read in your bio that you're a musician. I'm also a musician, and I find it fascinating. So you're saying it's a bit of a rigged game, that there are certain people, perhaps, who
yeah.
are being backed by big money interests, and there is others who are not. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. There's no doubt about it. Even the top novelists, by the way, were given money to write about their particular topic in the novel, and that's called predictive programming. We read through fiction, we see things through drama and fiction, things to come, and because subconsciously we accept it, it's no big surprise when it comes into real life, and we just adapt to it. We don't say no, we just think it must be a natural evolution, and it isn't. It's because we've been familiarized with it through drama and fiction, and we've been geared up to this point, and what's happened to society, we've lost our natural bonding with the people around about us. And we're being isolated even in our own homes, watching that little glowing tube every night. And that's giving us our indoctrination. And now people actually will prefer the glowing tube to talking to a real person half the time.
Yeah, it seems like if you come up with something that isn't purported off of that thing, then you're a conspiracy theorist.
yeah, I love it. I love the conspiracy theory. And that's been promoted from the top, again, to give it a label... to discredit it, and I say, well, what's the alternative? It's coincidence theories, because otherwise you're supposed to believe that everything that happens is just a coincidence. It's a coincidence that the New American Century Club published its agenda for the Middle East with a war beginning with Afghanistan, then Iraq, then Iran, then Syria in 1992. And all the major players are in power right now in the U.S. government that belong to that club. They republished it in 1998. And then they get their wish in 2001. They can start the ball rolling.
Quite the remarkable coincidence, huh?
Isn't it, though?
Well, you know, I've been gleaning just by watching life go by. I'm 58 years old now. That those who really seem to have the microphone in some kind of public forum somehow or another seem to be serving the power structure. Would you say that that's true in this sense, that the CIA, the MI6, have been supporting and promoting certain kinds of authors, certain kinds of musicians, certain kind of people in all across the spectrum of life?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I'm going to publish the declassified stuff that's there, and this is from governments. It's not, I'm not making it up or taking it from some comic book. This is from governments, and they come out with the top men who threw the money around and who promoted the big groups, the type of music, even the drug culture was imperative to get everyone on drugs. While they rushed an agenda through, everybody was stoned, nobody cared. Meanwhile, they had wars going on across the planet and in Latin America, and no one cared about them. This is all part of the agenda, and the promiscuity was to destroy the last vestiges of the family unit. They said that in their own writings, they'd have to destroy the family unit because it represented a form of small tribe, And their job was to eventually have the government talk directly to you as an individual with no one standing around you or between you and standing up for you. And that's where we're almost at today.
I agree. Now, the Dalai Lama is a bit of an enigma here because I'm a Tibetan Buddhist. We have a lot of Buddhists in Crestone where I live. In fact, you might call it Buddhaville. The Dalai Lama is certainly got the international microphone. You see his picture on the front page of the paper. You see Congress lining up to give him this Medal of Honor with bipartisan support. What function does the Dalai Lama play with this? Do you have
a
sense of that?
Back in the 1800s, when they knew that an elite knew that in Britain, for instance, they'd have to bring in a new religion for the world step by step. Now, we're dealing with people who plan in centuries even. And they created a theosophy. That was the first step. They wanted to get mainly women for the first time into a type of Freemasonic society. And they'd mix it with, and Blavatsky, she was the head of it, in her own words, it was to mix Eastern mysticism with Christianity, bring out a new religion, and then dispose of the old along the way. And that, so since then, they started to push out all the stuff about India primarily. They married it with Hinduism, and then they brought in Buddhism. And so these were all methods to train thousands, maybe even millions of people that nothing really mattered, nothing was real anyway. It was all illusion. And when you're all believing that, you can get pushed off in any direction. And that's what the purpose of that particular movement was. The Dalai Lama, I mean, he's born again and again and again. Well, the born-again Christians are only born once. So it's a con game. You must always use all the shepherds you can.
Well, you know, one thing you haven't talked about, although what you're saying is completely consistent with many things that I've read about the Rothschild banking family and Amschel Mayer Rothschild in 1776 founding the Illuminati with Adam Weishaupt and this then having a program for world domination, which would involve the abolition of religion, abolition of the family, abolition of private property,
yeah.
Abolition of all the institutions that might stand in the way of complete control of the masses by this very, very tiny elite. Would you care to, and of course this then might also have morphed into the Zionist movement and the communist movement.
Yeah.
Would you also see these as part and parcel of the same overarching plan?
There's no doubt about that part of it. Strategically, they looked upon the whole world and how they'd have to bring it down over time. And you'll find in the writings of the man who was put in as the lieutenant governor on behalf of the royalty. In other words, he had the rights of a king over Palestine in the 1920s and 30s. Was Sir Ronald Storrs, and he wrote his own memoirs. And in there he said that we have put in to the Middle East a new Ulster. And what he meant by that, he put in a different people with a different religion who end up dominating the rest, and it'll cause strife down through the ages, which you can then use eventually one day in the future and change the whole system as a resolution to the actual strife caused. Old techniques. And that's in his own book, and he was the top man that literally had the rights of a king in Palestine. So they knew that when he set up a new state of Israel, and they knew the conflict that they would cause by doing it, and that's why he called it a new Ulster, because England had done that in Northern Ireland. They put in a lot of Protestant, mainly Scotsmen actually, staunch Presbyterians who were loyal to the crown, the London crown. And they were called Orangemen after William of Orange. The Orange is the Orange Free State. Really, initially, it came from The Hague in Holland. And so he was backed by the bankers. This is an ongoing, long-term plan. And so they use all of these techniques, but especially, as I say, the religious differences and the different people. You're guaranteed strife. And even in ancient times, you'll find that some of the big conquerors in the Middle East would move whole populations into another population or a populated area and sit back and watch the fun and games and then change it all 100 years down the road.
I've read people talk about the world conspiracy as a Zionist conspiracy, as a Jewish conspiracy, as a Jesuit conspiracy, as a conspiracy of the international bankers. What is your take on it?
Well, yeah, they'd love to segregate it all from each other. It's all one part and parcel of the same thing, because when you go into the elite histories of the aristocracy, they don't care if you're Mohammedan or Jewish or Christian or whatever background. People at that level don't believe in the religions which they preside over. They're way beyond religion. They understand, they're taught very early on that religion is to control the public into an orderly society. And they don't believe what they call fairy tales or superstitions. They have their own religion at the top, and it's pretty well a form of Hinduism almost, which believes, I mean, that's where Darwinism comes from. You'll find it didn't start with Darwin. It started with Hinduism, where we started off as amoebas in the slime and gradually worked our way up from there. Survival of the fittest is all part and parcel of their religion. And they intermarry each other. You'll find people who supposedly are Jews or Christians or whatever intermarrying with the royal families if they curry enough favor and if they've done all the right kinds of work for the great work, as they call it, the global domination.
So are you saying that they're tracking genetically? It doesn't really matter what their affiliation is with? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they really don't, because at that level, they don't. It's like any aristocracy. There's a Jewish aristocracy. There's an Islamic aristocracy. There's always an aristocracy that separates itself from the people, even though they'll go to all the top holy sermons or functions, and the public see them as the best that they have, and they're all one of us. That's the idea. But they don't. They don't believe the same things either. The rest of the public believe.
One of the, well, many things, people like Anthony C. Sutton, who wrote the first book on Skull and Bones, secret fraternity out of Yale that our president and his father are in, believe that this group is basically satanic. Would you agree with that?
It's satanic in the sense that they worship themselves. If you look, what is a god, or what is even a Satan? A Satan is something, if you take even the Lucifer figure is more accurate, really, because in ancient religions there were two separate entities, Satan and Lucifer. Eventually they got mixed together, but Lucifer is Prometheus, who brings light to the world, intellect to those who can receive it. That's what it means. And these characters use this terminology about themselves. They believe they're the wisest and brightest, and therefore the most fit to rule over the lessers, those in the darkness, which they call the profane. That's what they mean by the darkness, those who don't understand. So it's a religion in that sense. Evil, there's no doubt about it. What's interesting, if you look at a psychopath and list up all of the scientific descriptions and classifications of psychopathy and the traits that they have, with no conscience, huge egos, how they'll do the audacious things, things that no one would ever expect to happen. And then you put it right next to what they used to call demonology. They're both identical, or demonic possession. In other words, they're cruel. They can plan the deaths or wars, which will kill off millions of people, profit from them, and go out and have parties after the meeting. I mean, that's not what we normally call human. So it's up to the individual if you want to accept their psychopaths or if there's something else to it. But the traits are identical.
Alan, I'm going to need to do a station identification here and a quick break, and then we'll get back. This is Truth Quest, and our guest tonight is Alan Watt with co-host Dr. Carlstrom. And this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I also wanted to read the disclaimer. The opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. And right now that they're having fun down at the Bongo Billy's for the KHEN's benefit party. And for those who want to catch the end of it there, it goes till 11 o'clock, and they're dancing with the 60s rock and roll with the Strolling Scones. And Wednesday, a Halloween fun night is being held at St. Joseph's Church, Great Hall, sponsored by the Kiwanis Club and Salida Ladies Elks Club. It will be held from 5:30 to 7. There will be games, prizes, treats, and a costume parade and fun for all ages. Two haunted houses, one for older children and adults, and one for the younger children, will be provided. Walmart will also have a Halloween costume parade from 4 to 5 p.m. on Halloween night. Judging will be at 5 p.m. This contest is open to anyone under the age of 12. Columbine Manor residents invite trick-or-treaters to visit them between 3 and 4 p.m. and will give treats. Again, this is a Truth Quest, and our guest is Alan Watt.
Alan, before we continue this line of questioning, which I think is pretty interesting, I would just like to mention to our listeners that your website is www.cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And are there any other particular websites or radio show outlets you would recommend to our listeners to kind of get more information and ideas from you?
I would tell them really to go into some of the better libraries of universities, especially the older universities, for histories. You don't have to go into the conspiratorial sites, because these are, a lot of them are set up to be misleading. And when you're putting fact out there to the public, which is, and it's not a nice message, I wouldn't be doing this unless I had to. It's not a nice message to give to the public, but it's imperative to hear it. When you give the facts out, you'll find that there are agencies out there, I'll call them agencies, that will grab those same facts, mix it with science fiction, spin it off in a loop until the average person will throw it all out the window, the baby goes with the bathwater. And that's called counterintelligence, a standard procedure. So I don't recommend they go into conspiracy anything. Or these guys will take any information and stick it in there, and you'll be more confused than ever. I would go into the histories of the foundations, because even Adam Weishaupt, now he was only one branch of the Bienen Orden, the order of the bees, that the beehive is a symbol, like Napoleon had eventually too, and it's like ancient Cleopatra had for Egypt, the perfectly ordered society. But Adam Weishaupt was only one member of one group of the same affiliations that was already worldwide, and he got too big for his boots. Said too much openly. His ego got the better of him. But what he did also say was, he says, we shall set up foundations, philanthropic foundations, and through these foundations we shall eventually dictate policies of governments. So, and that's what we have today.
That's non-governmental organizations?
Yes.
Okay.
You'll find all the non-governmental organizations are funded by the big foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford, Carnegie, etc., and the ones in Britain too. The Rothschild have many of them set up there, and they pay the NGO groups to front for them, to demand laws changed, that kind of stuff, demand policy changes in government on behalf of the foundations. And sure enough, the governments are only too happy to accept. Now, the Soviet system was based upon exactly the same system. Only the Politburo picked the leaders of the NGO groups, who would then rally the mob, demand laws get passed on behalf of the people, and again, the Politburo were quite happy to oblige them. It's the same system disguised here under different terminology, but it's exactly the same system. And you'll find that even Albert Pike of Freemasonry talked about this. He said, we shall accumulate wealth by all means possible. He says, even with by the stock market, by playing the stock market or rigging it. And he said, we shall become masters over the masters of the world. We shall be financially. So that was another branch of the same group.
Okay. It's clear that you've done an enormous amount of reading. And, of course, this separates you from you know, 99.8 or 99.9% of the public. So the problem that I see that, and I'm afraid I'm also in that category since I'm a professor and I've been reading a lot, the problem that I have with friends who are kind of firmly embedded in the matrix, they don't know whether to listen to me and I make sense or to Rush Limbaugh and he makes sense. This is what a good friend of mine told me, and I was shocked when I heard him say this because he's a smart guy. But he's a Republican and he's bought into those that set of assumptions. And without that kind of background reading, I don't know how you break out of the matrix. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, what I find is that, strangely enough, when you look at the overall picture, no one can truly say they're ignorant of what's been happening in their lifetime. No one can truly say that. We've all heard that even the same major media blitzes on certain topics given to us. We all live through the implementation of every country in the Western Hemisphere signing the same anti-terrorism laws, which is martial law, at the same time. Now, what kind of coincidence is that? There was no difference at all in the wording, and eventually it's quite obvious when you read through them that this is worse than the Soviet system. When all these laws which are passed already are implemented, we're going to be living in a worse hell than the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, because they're implemented to look for terrorism, and terrorism is being expanded now right down to even thought crime, speech crime, and all this kind of stuff. It'll continue to expand, and George Bush himself wanted psychological evaluation of every child at every age, every year through school, that would eventually go into adulthood. This is the Brave New World system, where one day they'll say, well, you might have a thought crime there, you might be a terrorist one day, we'll have to fix you now.
So they can't send...
We've all lived through this was major media.
So what you're saying is that my good friend really doesn't have a very good excuse except for the will not to see what's right in front of him. Because
it's,
really, it's too scary.
It's coming down to that.
It's too scary.
Now,
okay.
It's also true, we've never had people as we have today that have been given what Bertrand Russell called a scientific indoctrination. No one's had as much of it as we've had. That's true. We're also getting modified food. And the UN even admitted the IQ has dropped in the last few years. The IQ level doesn't drop by itself. Something causes it to happen, because you're born with it, it's innate. And so if the IQ is dropped, and they've actually lowered the IQ level in the scoring test to make it more official, what caused it to drop? What's happened in 50 years? We've had inoculation started, being pressed up, pushed to the maximum. We've seen autism go sky high. We've seen all the other grades of autism, attention deficit and so on. These are all grades of the same problem, and you'll see the problems all began with inoculation. We've all been worked on. We're being bioengineered, in fact. And if you were the top masters of this whole plan and you're at war with the people of the world, you would use every weapon in your arsenal, and you'd do it as secretly as possible. And what better way than convince the public that it's all in their own interests?
So you often mention something about the spraying in the sky on some of your programs. You might elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, you'll find, going back into the 50s and 60s, there was a doctor, Teller, who worked for the Pentagon. He was the father of the H-bomb. And he came up with a plan to spray the skies with metallic particles, aluminum oxides, barium, and other types. And they could then use the HARP technology, that's the High Altitude Auroral Research Program, electromagnetic pulsing. They could use that through the atmosphere, which would then be more conductive, and they could affect the moods, the mindsets, and even the general health of the population. And since for the last 10 years, in 98, you'll find that most countries on the planet have been getting, at the very least, weekly doses and very often daily doses of aerial spraying. You'll see the jets going back and forth and crisscrossing the sky and leaving these trails behind them, the scurried at the top trying to hide it up and say, oh, it's condensation trails. I have a memory. I remember what condensation trails were like. They didn't last for more than a minute. These things last for hours, and they spread, and they create a type of haze over the sky. And when it comes down, the population end up with bronchial problems and various other problems because of the chemicals that's in the spray. Now, the spray's been tested. I did it myself, too. And it does have aluminum oxide in it and barium and other metallic particles. Yeah.
And their purpose in that is to modify our actions? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they found... Now, if you go into the HAARP Treaty, the Weather Warfare Treaty, the United Nations signed in the 1970s, they talked about this particular HAARP, that's H-A-A-R-P technology, and they have one base in Alaska, they have another one in Greenland, they have 54 worldwide, and they can triangulate them all together and focus on a whole continent if they want to. And in that treaty, it said that they can cause earthquakes, tsunamis with it, they can cause hurricanes, tornadoes, but they can also put a secondary signal along with the HAARP, which will affect the human psyche, your mind. And they could actually make you very depressed, or by adjusting the frequency, they can make you elated and or laid back. And if you look at people today with everything that's happening, they're far too calm under the circumstances.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Or they're in shock, some
yeah.
combination thereof, yeah. I imagine that you also, since you seem to really have this broad view, you're probably pretty well aware of the militarization of space issues as well, and
yep.
the Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative kinds of funding, the kinds of high-tech technologies that would allow one country or one group of people to win all future wars. And this is,
yes,
we are paying
and
for
all
this.
This hype right now that there are front men out there to stop the weaponization of space, well, they're 30 years too late. It's already been done. And during the whole Cold War, NASA's main function, it still is, it's not to go out there and do a Star Trek series for us. It's actually to service and put up these particular weapons and all the monitoring equipment that's eventually going to track every citizen on the planet. That's the real purpose of NASA.
So just complete, total control of the world's population.
Yes, the British ID card is already out. And it's not just in Britain, it's across Europe. And they even have ads on television. And they have it's even in their comedy shows where the mother says to the child, don't leave home without it. And the child says, what's that, your ID card? Some countries you can't get in a subway or on a bus or in a taxi without it. And these have active chips in them, and they're monitored from cell phone towers, which are all across cities, they're everywhere. And that's part of the tracking. Eventually, now they've come out with the latest information, of course, that'll lead to the next step. It's always a step-by-step acceptance by the public. It seems like a natural progression. The next step is to get an embedded chip, and you'll be tracked everywhere you go.
And
you can do it, again, via these cell phone towers, and again, even beam them off into satellites and back again. That's what it's all set up to do.
And in one of your articles, you talk about the kind of the vulnerability, the jeopardy, indeed, of sentience itself, based on the what could happen with the chipping of people's brains.
Yeah. Well, in the Daily Mail newspaper, that's dailymail.uk, a couple of days ago, there's an article published there about the new types of humans that are going to be coming out shortly. They're talking about two classes forming, the ones who are superior, genetically enhanced, and then inferior types. And the same newspapers in the past have carried articles about chips, etc., monitoring, following, and all that kind of stuff. But now they're talking as well in the same media about interfacing us with computers, and that we won't even need basic memory anymore, because we'll be downloaded like a cyborg, part human, part machine, and how much more beneficial it will be. So they're all hyping up this whole agenda. And you can go back again to the writings of Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, to the big players in predictive programming. They made us familiar with the ideas as far back as the 1950s and 60s. And these two guys belong to the World Futurist Society. That's also a huge foundation outlet. They pick certain authors, they tell them what they want the public to have in their minds, and then they tell them to write a story around it. And those two guys were picked. They went through the scenario with Isaac Asimov, where they have the cyborg-type humans, that the types of changes will all go through when it happens. And Arthur C. Clarke wrote the book 2001 in the 1960s, because the whole agenda was to kick off in 2001, which it did. I don't know if people even realize that the foundations of the Pentagon were laid on September the 11th, 1941. That was a big ceremony for it. They loved that date, September the 11th. And
Could you tell us why?
Clark wrote about the next step is to be the unification of everything, 2010, and then it's to be the he goes on to the next 1,000 years, 3001, with a whole new society, with all the letter types killed off.
Wasn't the towers also dedicated on September 11th? Am I?
Yeah, and George Bush's speech, George Bush Sr., his speech on the coming New World Order, the big idea, as he called it, was given on September 11th, 1990, and then he followed it on the following year, September 11th, 1991.
So they love.
How's that for a coincidence?
Yeah, so they love numerology then.
Yeah.
Well, and I
they also love
one.
To mock the public who don't remember.
Yeah, September 11th was also the day, I believe, when the coup occurred in Chile, which took out democratically elected Salvador Allende and installed the dictator Pinochet, who then did whatever 30 years of terrorism in Chile to establish a fascist regime. So,
yes.
So yes, they do like September 11th.
But September 11th as well, you see, the Ides of a month go up until about the 13th. And so September, the Ides of September, it goes right into September the 11th, in old Greek and then eventually into Roman mythology. That's when basically Athena was born. Athena is the goddess warrior, almost a hermaphroditic figure, very masculine, that was self-born through the head of Zeus. Its own will brought it into existence. And so something which could never have happened by itself was willed into existence. They have brought their will, their order, into existence.
You've given us a little bit of their timetable, that the world all comes together in 2010, and then what else was to follow that?
2010 is the complete working integration of the Americas.
Okay.
2012 was to be when the United Nations declares openly that it's now in charge, and we're all basically provinces underneath it.
So then you're talking about the North American Union, the and the Pan-American Union, is that correct? Or?
That's right. They have a whole bunch of other Latin American countries lined up to join. But the main ones, of course, Canada, the U.S., Mexico, they've signed the third agreement towards integration. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations came out openly on Canadian television, the CBC Corporation. They came out openly as their own group for the first time. In the past, they've been on as advisors to people, but this time they came out as their own Council on Foreign Relations with their logo behind them, and they boasted, this is 2005, they boasted that they drafted up this new integration policy, and they presented it to the governments to sign, and then they went into why they'd have to, we have to amalgamate and become interdependent. And then when you shoot back before that, you'll find during the free trade negotiations in the 80s, they even debated where to put the new capital, because you've got to get a new capital city, that's the new bureaucratic city, and they decided Montreal was the one they favored most.
Mm. As far as you can tell, are they on track? Are they on target to meet their dates?
Absolutely.
Well, then that doesn't give us a lot of hope that we can stall or thwart this plan? What would you say?
You're right, and that's why isn't it so fortunate that we're under this really martial law situation right now under the guise of terrorism, and they're rushing it all forward. And under martial law, you don't have anyone to complain to. They're pushing all of this ahead for national security. On the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, they even had they even called it Fortress America. That's what George Bush was calling it. The amalgamation would become Fortress America with integrated bureaucracies, customs officials would be totally integrated. Now, they already are at the borders. CSIS, that's the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, would be totally integrated with the CIA. That's already happened because the Canadian border officials are using FBI computers now with all the data on American citizens. That's in the newspapers here.
So where does the prisons come in this? I mean,
well, I got an article from the British Department of Defense, which is also from the top think tank, and it was published in the London Guardian newspaper. It was a 9-page report of a 90-page report. I have the whole 90 pages on my website, and that came out a few months ago. And they had envisaged nothing but riots, constant ongoing escalating riots coming from the general population from now, or from the very near future, right up into to about 2030. And they talked about all the weaponry they'd have to use to contain all this violence. Nowhere did they say why Joe Public would be rioting in the first place. But remember, this is the top think tank for the British Department of Defense. It's also the top one for NATO. The U.S. is part of NATO. So what's scheduled now is a complete takedown of the old society, something that the elite have been after for a long time, the abolition of all private property for the ordinary person, the new system of habitat areas and the new indoctrinations, the creation of the new types of humans to come along. It's full steam ahead. It's the whole agenda that they're going for right now.
So have you heard anything about the supercomputers that they've actually run a parallel population? Is this maybe where they're getting this idea of knowing what we're going to do in the next 30-some years?
Well, what's interesting is that I've got the articles on my website from the main sources, and the CIA set it up for the Americas, a parallel existence, a network reality where they've taken everyone's ID, all the information they have on you, personality profiles, and given a double of you that exists within the internet, like a matrix system. And I was thinking to myself, you know, when they give us interfacing, even though it's like brief moments of interfacing with the computer, they're even talking about using it in the business world where you'll be at virtual meetings and so on, and they're given a sense of presence so you'll feel what seems to be the person next to you, although you haven't even left your own room. You're still sitting on your own. This is all real. It's been in IBM magazines, etc. So they're making an individual, or a replica of every single individual, and the Pentagon's involved in this, by the way. And they're not telling us why they're doing it, but how easy it would be to get you to start to go into a matrix relaxation a state for, say, half an hour a day for a couple of years, gradually get introduced until you wouldn't know which one you were in eventually.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And the point being that if you flipped over into the other system, then you would lose your autonomy. Is that correct?
That's right.
Then you would be under the control. You would be then a kind of a...
Well, they've already said, what they've said, in fact, the human being, the brain capacity is so large that you could literally think you were the Moonraker or James Bond on the moon or in bed with a beautiful woman. Meanwhile, you could actually be cleaning out a barn in reality, but you would never know it.
So then this kind of slavery might be pleasant?
Yeah.
Could be anyway, huh? Except for this is not.
And that's what they say, and Huxley said it himself. He said, I'll do Huxley at his speech at Berkeley, and I've got that on my site too. People should listen to this man. Big player. He knew the agenda. He was in Tavistock Institute. He worked for them. And he's talking about genetic manipulation in the 1930s when he wrote the book. long before supposedly they discovered the genes. And he's writing about all the different kinds of humans they would create for doing all the menial tasks and so on. But in his speech at Berkeley, he talks about why a scientific dictatorship not only should work, but would work. And that he could see no reason why it wouldn't take over and could run forever. The public would never, ever know what happened to them. He said most people are unhappy anyway. What he didn't stress is the fact that, yeah, he knew that because the system they'd given us already with worry and debt and poverty or keeping ahead or keeping alive is meant to keep you stressful. That's the system that's designed. And he says most people are unhappy anyway. He says what's wrong in using drugs or putting wires in their brain to make them happy?
So you were saying earlier about these different humans. What were they going to do with the ones that were already here then? Or were they going to become those, or were they going to get rid of
us? Well, it's an odd thing in history. When you look at even the Egyptian pharaohs, the whole idea of embalmment was to try to contain the body forever, because the dream of all those who've ever had it so good, what they call the good life, as Bertrand Russell called it, a life which is pretty well stress-free, which it always is if you're psychopathic, you don't carry stress around with you. However, they have the good life, they have all the their sensations attended to an excess, they love life, and immortality has always been one of their goals. David Suzuki, who also works for the World Wildlife Fund and does lots of nature programs, and who is a geneticist, in fact, said on national television in Canada, he said, we have the ability now to make a person live till they're 500 if we want to, barring accidents, you know. However, since the whole mandate of the United Nations is population reduction, because they do have a Department of Population Control at the United Nations. And I keep asking people, what do you think they mean by control? They don't sit and make wish lists up. They enact them. And they do it. They bring the populations down. They can't ask for volunteers, so they simply do it. So they have the ability to give life extension for incredibly long periods if they want to, but they're not going to give it to everyone. It's only going to be for themselves. And so, technically, even from a religious side, if you're into religion, it will be the dream of a demon. A demon, by mythology or ancient standards, used to be something which held to a demon was the absence of the physical body and sensation. Like a mind in space, you couldn't feel anything, just a mind that could think. And so heaven to a demon is to have the occupation of a host or a home. And it's so interesting to look at all the religions at the top and what they're all into. Even Maurice Strong, if you go into his little Bacca Grande group there with all the different religious leaders he brings in there, they're all into this fixing the spirit or themselves, or call it a demon if you want to, into the physical body forever, both unified on earth forever. That's the goal.
Now, I'm afraid the idea of fixing the spirit to a body forever still escapes me. Is this supposed to be done with science, with genetics? What?
Absolutely, through genetics as well. They understood what they called the time or clock gene, aging gene, a long time ago. And once you understand the bottom level of physics or biology, or any of the sciences, is from professorship down. Higher sciences are kept quiet and kept out of the mainstream. And we found this, for instance, with Nick Begich, who came out with technology that the CIA had used in the 1950s, and he demonstrated it on the CBC television here on Wendy Mesley show. He told her to stand 20 feet away. He pointed this little thing about the size of a TV remote at her head, and she heard music in the middle of her head. And he said, I could easily put words in just the same. This was solid-state technology. It was so small, it had to be, before the public were even given access to what we thought were transistors were the latest thing. That was the next step. But they were already in microcircuitry, and the CIA had that in the 1950s, and they were using it on different people, who no doubt got locked up in institutions for hearing voices.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a whole table of this stuff, and he says, this is all obsolete.
Wow.
Obsolete. So the higher sciences are always kept from the general populace, and that's how you keep control of the world. Everything that's given to the public is obsolete, technically. It's never going to be used as a threat to a ruling minority, and that's the way they like to keep it. And I often thought it was so weird that they're using basically the same firearms, updated, okay, but they're firing ball and powder through various weapons today for the military, and yet they have scalar technology weapons that can wipe out whole battlefields just by putting a beam of light across it if they want to. But they want us all to still be back into this old-fashioned way. This is the best we've got. So when they turn the new weaponry on the public, it'll be quite the surprise.
Well, indeed. And we had our first interview, Melody and I, with Dr. Jim Fetzer, who was the founder of Scholars for 911 Truth. And we talked 2 hours about mostly about how the World Trade Center 1 and 2 may have come down with some combination of cutter charges that would be more or less conventional, but also using perhaps mini nukes and, most intriguingly, Star Wars beams of some kind. And he's coming around to that conclusion. And, of course, I think that this would be a very unpopular conclusion from the point of view of the government. If this gets out that this might have been the case, then they would lose the element of surprise, wouldn't they?
To be honest with you, I don't even go there. And I'll tell you why I don't go there. By studying history and studying even people who wrote in retrospect of history, people who helped plan wars, and how to pull off major wars, and who then published their memoirs, they've all said the same thing. It's not necessary that it's not important even if the public are fixated upon the start of something. It's just because we must also be so quick to implement new changes quickly in the first few years. Once that's happened, you cannot switch it off. And so all they need is a spark to start it. And even if they came out with proof afterwards, yep, we did it, it wouldn't matter. This agenda is on a roll now. And what they say is that no army is ever pulled out of the field once they're put in there until the job's done. And even if you change governments, they'll say the same thing. Well, we can't take the people out. There'll be chaos in that land if we pull them out now. That's what they'll say.
Are you then agreeing or disagreeing with the Star Wars hypothesis for how the World Trade Center buildings came down?
Oh, I don't think they even needed Star Wars technology. I'll tell you, do you know who rebuilt and bomb-proofed the World Trade Center after the first World Trade bombing?
No.
It was the Bin Laden-Bush amalgamation. Do you realize that the Bin Laden's family are the biggest builders of bomb-proof shelters across the planet?
Okay. No, I didn't know that. Thank you.
How did everybody else miss that?
In Canada, the CBC showed that on the day of September the 11th, 2001, when this was happening, George Bush Sr., the senior partner with the Bin Laden Consortium, the family, were at a meeting in another part of New York at the time that explosion happened.
Now, I've heard that, but I didn't realize that they were the ones that had reinforced the building.
They were the ones that got the contract, yeah.
Okay, so did they reinforce it, or did they play a part in...
I suspect the first one was that it was the excuse to get in and plant everything they eventually used.
Okay. That's a very interesting idea and perhaps true. You're tying a lot of things together here. One thing that maybe is still confusing to a lot of us is this idea of a psychopath. And you actually have a word for rule by psychopaths, I believe, that you use, don't you? What do you call a world run by psychopaths? You call it...
A pathocracy.
A pathocracy, yeah. I couldn't quite say that, pathocracy. Okay, so a psychopath then is someone who can kill, steal... lie, cheat, swindle, without feeling remorse. Is that correct?
Yes, they can be emotional. They can show emotion. I've seen some exposés of some of them on television that helped to get the Vietnam War on the go, and they can get all emotional, tears can come from their eyes, especially when they're talking about them being awarded high honors, etc., because they are egocentric. The world revolves around the psychopath, and they have an ability, a gift they're born with, of studying people, knowing intuitively how people work, in a sense, and how to manipulate them for their own ends. And they do not feel remorse about anything. They have no guilt. Winston Churchill used to order major battles to proceed, even though they knew that their forces would get wiped out, like Dieppe. He knew that, and so did Lord Mountbatten. They knew that this plan to give a trial invasion of France at Dieppe by the Canadian troops, they knew that the Germans had heavily reinforced that and that they didn't have a chance, but they set it off anyway. And that night, Winston Churchill was getting drunk at parties. These guys have no conscience.
And, okay, so the two kind of directions that the species then could go, one would be towards this manipulated drone slave genetic being that you're talking about. The other would be the master race, and the master race would be psychopaths. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's interesting how they themselves put it. I mean, Charles Galton Darwin. Remember, the Darwin family is extremely interesting because they were already practicing special selective breeding in Charles Darwin's day. These families were already practicing this. It wasn't new. The Darwin family only intermarried for generations one other family, and that was the Wedgwood family of the Wedgwood famed pottery, you know. And Charles Darwin's grandfather married one, his father married a Wedgwood. Charles Darwin's, when his wife died, he married her sister, who was also his aunt, another Wedgwood. They were already practicing selective breeding for special traits. And that's been going on for a long time amongst these high elite types. But along with that, you can also breed traits in or out. And Plato talked about this in his book, The Republic. He said, eventually we shall breed humans like animals. We can breed out certain traits by interbreeding certain ones or breed in certain traits. Well, if you have psychopathy there and you're always marrying and inbreeding psychopaths, you're pretty well guaranteed another psychopath.
Yeah, you know, I imagine you've seen the documentary video called The Corporation.
Yeah,
it's fascinating because the person who made it was also knew something about psychology, and he decided to try to do a psychological profile of corporations based on their behavior, and he came up with the behavior of corporations identifies them as a classic psychopath.
Yeah.
And yet he also points out that this entity, this legal fiction that we call a corporation, has been legally engineered to have these characteristics, to kill and steal and lie, etc., without guilt, without feeling remorse, and to do so indefinitely because a corporation can live forever. So in a sense, the corporation then seems to have become kind of an institutional mirror of that mindset.
It is, and that's the dilemma we're in. You see, psychopaths down through the ages, especially since the introduction of money, that was the key to it. They are the most aggressive, the most cunning. They know how to manipulate others to do work for them. They end up at the top. And as long as we have the same system, we'll have the psychopaths at the top. They're ruthless. They'll claw their way up there. They don't care who they destroy to get there. And they've given us a psychopathic culture to emulate. And I'm not kidding about that. Our whole culture is a psychopathic culture. We might not feel it. We might feel things, might feel sorrow, might feel pity, but in reality, the culture we're in is about winners and losers. And we're trained at school to compete, 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 right up the ladder, go into the workforce, compete, compete, get to the top. And when you get to the top, you're worshipped by the public. The public worship the Donald Trumps and all these characters. They worship the stars. And because the culture we're given is a psychopathic one, and as long as we have it, there's only one way we can go. That's the road out of Eden, as they say. It's this path we're on right now.
And money and the creation of money is really at the center of this whole process. Is that correct?
Yes. So money came from an old Middle Eastern term for men, because you counted the heads of your slaves, and eventually that became money. That's where the term comes from. And we are technically slaves in this system. We're owned according to all the laws. Anyone who's registered to any government is owned. Same with your car. That's why they can steal your car from you. They actually own it. And so we registered, we are owned. And as I say, this is a psychopathic culture. And the further we go along in it, the more and more people are becoming psychopathic like themselves as they accept the culture, which is showing its teeth now, is bearing itself, and it's showing itself of what it is. And when we lose that common bond between each other, then we're all at the mercy of the ones at the top.
Well, this is why the destruction of Christianity is important to their long-term plan, the destruction of the church, because for whatever faults it has, it does preach kindness, tolerance, love of your neighbor, love of your enemy, and protection of the poor.
Well, it's been so warped over the ages, too, though. When you look into the Latin, and then you go into the Hebrew, and you look into the other Aramaic languages, it's been changed so many times for political purposes, mainly by those at the top, and that have taken the teeth out of it. It was never meant to be an institution. How come these top churches, who have all their sheep following them, never tell their congregations what's going on?
Good point. Good point.
Neither the Vatican nor any of the big boys of the Billy Graham caliber come out and say, wait a minute, people, you're being poisoned, you're being manipulated. The UN has a department of population reduction. Here's what's been happening to you. None of them will do that. Christianity, when it came out, was supposed to be an individual thing. Once it becomes institutionalized, it's now an organization which is ruled by a leader. All you do is put in the leader, and then you have all the sheep follow.
So, what numbers have you heard about their population reduction? Is there, is it something like the Georgia Guidestones, or?
Oh no, long before that. I got old British books. I was so interested in this propaganda we were given, because about too many people that started to come out about the 70s. They started to get the drum beats going then. And I got a hold of old books on the very same topic written around the 1920s, where many authors were pointing out the true statistics, because the con game of overpopulation was getting put out there by the days of Malthus. And Thomas Malthus was an East Indian economist for East India Company, for the British Crown again, who owned that company. And Malthus came out with the necessity of population reduction, and again the same thing, the fear of the commoners breeding too quickly, and there'd be too many of them, they would outbreed the elite. And so he devised ways of reducing the population, restricting diets of certain things, changing the diets, putting housing up in swampland so they'll die off quicker. All of this kind of stuff was all advocated. And should read he put a book out on it, you know. People should get a hold of that book and read it. That's how far back this whole thing goes. But he also brought out graphs. And it's like Theo Roosevelt said. He says, there are lies, there are damned lies, and then there are statistics. If you call something a statistic, it sounds much more scientific and we swallow it. Well, Malthus came out with all these statistics and graphs to show how the population, by the year about 1900, or even before that, we'd all be walking over each other according to his own data. And as they've been using lies from the very beginning to try and prove this data of overpopulation. What it is in history, if you look at the history of elite rulers and dynasties, they always turn around and try to kill off certain portions of their population because they become paranoid. They know what they're up to will get caught on to eventually, and they become paranoid and they want to cull the population to a manageable level. It's just the same old thing again.
What about the global warming?
The global warming is a beauty, because The Club of Rome is one of the biggest foundations. They're a planner. What they do is come up with ideas to manipulate the public, the whole worldwide. And they're authorized. They're affiliated with the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Bilderbergers and so on. But their speciality is to find ways to bring the world into a cohesive structure. And they published a book, the two founders published a book in the 1970s, and it's called The First Global Revolution. And it's by the Club of Rome. People should get a copy for about 75 cents. Yes, used, no problem. In the book, they said, we sat around the think tanks trying to find ways to unite the planet. Invasions from Mars, all that stuff was discussed. Could they convince the public where we're getting invaded from outer space? Would that take a lot of propaganda? How many years would it take? Then they said, we hit upon the better idea. We'd claim that the public were causing the planet to warm up and they were destroying it. Therefore, man would become the enemy of the planet. And then they'd take over all the land, etc., to manage it better so they could save it, etc. It's all in their own book.
And the carbon credit thing, am I saying that right? The carbon credits,
Oh, the carbon credits. Oh, how beautiful. You know, King James the first, you know, King James, he gave us the King James Bible. He brought out the fresh air tax and the light tax in his day. And that's why you see a lot of windows walled up in old homes in Britain, the old homes that existed back then. He was taxing you on how many window panes you had in the windows, and if you could open the windows to let the air in, and they called it the fresh air tax and the light tax. We're seeing the same farcical things being repeated again, and I'm trying to give it scientific explanations. We are being extorted. It's as simple as that.
Well, I find your insights to be totally fascinating because I must admit I've been fooled by some of these issues myself over time, and I'm starting to, pull the curtain back myself and starting to see the patterns that you've also discovered. So what I'm gathering, the think tanks, the foundations, the secret societies are ways in which these elites can network and promote a common agenda internationally towards a plan which was defined perhaps centuries and millennia ago.
Yes, it was. As I say, they had what was termed today international meetings. The Concert of Europe was one of the biggest ones. Where they set up the future agenda. They knew they couldn't keep this game up of pretending to fight each other and live off of the profits of their armaments and supplies, etc., because wars are very profitable. And they looked towards a global system and how they would pull it off, bring it about. And even before World War I, people like H.G. Wells. Now, H.G. Wells was trained himself by Sir Thomas Huxley, the grandfather of Aldous Huxley. Sir Thomas Huxley had what they called the Red Tie Club. Each member got a red tie for revolution, and they were funded by, again, the British aristocracy. They trained authors to go out to bring in these predictive programming novels into us, so we'd all kind of want to go in that direction, never realizing the whole plan. And before World War I, H.G. Wells wrote and said, we need a world war to bring this into fruition, to bring the beginnings of a world government together. Before he did that, you had poets like Shelley. Shelley wrote the poem about the Parliament of Man, and that was, you find that presidents of the United States used to read that. We find it with Truman. Truman used to read that poem, the end of that poem at every major speech he gave. He'd pull it out and he says, when the cannons roar no more, etc., and we'll all be together in the Parliament of Man. This was written in the 1800s.
Could you, Alan, this is my curiosity, and I think it still might be interesting to many others. You kind of summed up the situation in the Baca very quickly in terms of the unification of spirit and extension of life, and the reason why maybe Hannah and Marie Strong have cultivated this series of spiritual groups, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, etc., for their own purposes in some way, but I can't quite get my mind around it yet. Could you explain that a little better?
Well, yes. Everything that's happened for the last couple of hundred years, and probably more, they've always needed the compliance of the public. And we do. We go along with everything that happens. World wars come along. We go along with it. Unquestioningly, we're taxed more for wars, as always, to keep us safe. And meanwhile, every war, like Carl quickly said, is to change society. That's its main function, because governments grow exponentially when the wartime is there. They take over all industries, all agriculture, everything that's vital for survival. They take it over, but they never let it go. And that's the reason for modern warfare, is to take over every facet of human existence and put it into the hands of bureaucracies that serve their masters at the top. So they need us to acquiesce. We acquiesce to so much in our lifetimes by our silence. We say nothing. Now, for years when we thought we had it good, especially in the Americas, in the 50s and 60s, when there was a sigh of relief after world wars and people tried to have a good life themselves, they forget that Truman, for instance, wrote into law a series of ongoing wars. They realized that without World War II, the Great Depression wouldn't have stopped. People don't realize it wasn't just the 20s. It went right through the 30s, too. It was World War II. And the borrowing of money that suddenly appeared, of course, they had none before, but suddenly they could borrow money and they could have a world war, that's what pulled them out of the depression. And they were afraid to go right back into it because half their industry was based on war production and materials. And so for 50 years, you've had wars all over the planet, ongoing wars. Latin America, the School of the Americas has been training people and sending them down there to assassinate and kill and slaughter for 50 years. Ongoing wars. So when we were dancing it away and having a good time, we were oblivious to the fact that people were getting slaughtered all over the planet. And anyone who wouldn't go along with this world agenda or adopt the same culture, which is also an imperative, they won't allow any other competing culture to exist as this one or nothing, then it'd have to be eliminated. Well, we're seeing it all come together today, because the only countries left are those in the Middle East that are different and they're not standardized. We're seeing the standardization of the whole planet.
And the situation in Crestone and the spiritual groups and the unification of spirit and matter that you were talking about there?
Well, for the elite themselves, they claim that's what they'll have. As for the general population, I don't know. All I can say by observing the general population, I think anyone who's followed this and who has a drive to follow it, you find you are different, because when you look around you, you do realize most people don't want to know. And you have to ask yourself, why am I so different from them? I think we all get to that stage. And you ask, is there anything in you that's not in them? Because you have no more... Why is a minority aware of what's happening? And why are they so concerned when the rest hear the same kind of news and toss it out of their minds? They don't want to know it. Another good part of the population is they're all into all the different religions and the New Age, where they just meditate for themselves and pretend everything's happy. Why are we so different? I don't know. I don't know if there's something different with us genetically, or if there's something in us that makes us different. All I know is we are different, but we also care about society. What you find about the majority of the public today, they don't care about anyone except themselves.
See, in my mind, I would say that is really a spiritual gene, to have compassion for other beings, to have a compassion for suffering creatures in Africa, people in other parts of the world that have been, you know, stomped on by the boot of empire.
Yeah.
I would say that's true spirituality, but I guess, yeah. You know, these are just terms, you know.
Yeah, and there's definitely something there. I mean, why do most people... And I noticed during the Vietnam era, where it became the standard fare for people to munch their dinner in the evening and watch the news, and they're watching people getting napalmed, and it eventually didn't affect them. They were being desensitized.
Mm-hmm.
And today, we know what's happening over in the Middle East. It's total war, and I mean total war. in Iraq, they weren't hitting the wrong targets when they blew up baby food factories. You go after the infrastructure for survival for the whole population. That's what they were doing. And they disguised it by a mistake. There are no mistakes today. They're having total war on populations, and the majority back home don't care. They don't care.
Well, Alan, if we can kind of sum up what... I mean, we covered a lot of subjects.
Yeah, this has been tremendous. I appreciate your tremendous insights. It's really, really stunning.
Yes, and I really appreciate you coming on and spending this time with us. And I'd love to have you back again sometime. And in the meantime, you can be heard on RBN with your own program, the Republic Broadcasting Network, correct?
Yeah.
And then WTPRN, you have a program on Thursday evenings, too?
That's scheduled, yeah.
Okay. Oh, so you haven't started it yet, so.
No.
Okay. And then your website is Cutting Through the Matrix.
Yeah. And I'll also be doing my own podcasting as well.
And all I can
I give educational talks every so often with the histories and all the books you should get a hold of. And advise people to beware of following leaders. They always give us leaders who always lead us off in the wrong directions. And we've got to start becoming individuals again, because the elite said a long time ago they'd have to destroy this cult of individuality. The individual is unpredictable. The collective is much more predictable. They want a predictable society to control.
And you have a list of books that you recommend somewhere?
I have them on my website.
Okay.
And in lots of my talks. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Yeah.
Well, again, thanks a lot, Alan. And
we sure appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And we'll send you a copy of this interview.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And this has been Truth Quest. And coming up next will be Joe Frank. And this is KHEN 106.9 Salida. And this, again, like I said, is Truth Quest with Dr. Carlstrom and Melody. And I guess they're winding down at the Psychedelic 60s Halloween Bash that they had for the fundraiser tonight. And I guess I'll run over there and help them clean up. And then again, the City of Salida Public Works Department has begun the Water and Sewer Main Upgrade Project on West 1st Street, Highway 291. The project will be ongoing and until approximately October 31st. Okay. They've scratched so much out, and I'm kind of lost what this meaning of it is, but it sounds like they're going to be working on West 1st for public service Public Works Department project. So again, coming up now is Joe Frank.